And welcome, 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 friends, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Mark Eichmann, in for Cherry Gregg. Coming up this hour, we hear from a memory researcher at Temple University about how we create memories, what affects our memory, and how can we trust our recollections.
And then, actually before that, really, we have PA State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams. I have to remember the order today, Mark. He's going to join us to talk about why he is aligning himself with the new centrist Forward Party. And at the end of the show, we play another round of trivia. But first, Mark, we have to dig into some news stories. And we saved this one special for you because it happened earlier in the week. We're going to talk about the Flyers, the Philadelphia Flyers, the ice hockey team located here in our fair city. They announced earlier this week that they are changing their uniforms for the first time since 2010. I trust that they are changing the uniforms because I can't even tell that they changed anything. The logo is the same, right?
Correct.
The color of orange on the jersey has changed slightly.
Very slightly. They're going back a little bit retro with a darker orange, not the bright orange okay. We've seen over the last couple of years, a darker orange.
And it's called burnt orange?
Burnt orange.
Okay. Why are they doing this, Mark? I mean, explain this to me. People seem to think this is a big deal. I can't wrap my head around it.
I don't know that it's a big deal. I think they're doing it, uniform changes always revolve around commerce a little bit, right?
To sell
some
jerseys,
new uniforms, to sell the t-shirts, right? But there's also sort of the Flyers need a change. Mm-hmm. They've been not playing well over the last couple of years. So this is a little bit of a shakeup in the look. There's also a little bit of a shakeup in the front office, a lot of a shakeup in the front office. And it sort of reflects the retro look that they're going for with these jerseys. They've sort of gone retro in the front office, bringing back a number of former Flyers to now lead the team to hopefully better results.
So what I hear, Mark, is you saying they want to distract us from the fact that they've been terrible recently. And they're like, remember when we used to be good? That's the idea.
It can't hurt, right?
That's right. It can't hurt.
I mean, you look at the bottom right. line and the record of the last couple of years, you want to forget. So focus on the shiny new jerseys a little bit to distract us from poor results. But hopefully with these new old guys coming back to the Flyers with Danny Briere, with John LeClair as a special advisor, Keith Jones as team president,
okay.
who's familiar to a lot of hockey fans beyond just
the
Flyers.
I do know those names, and I'm not a big hockey guy, but I do know those names. So I'll ask you a question. Are you going to buy a new shirt or a new jersey?
Well, my sons are very excited about it, so I don't know if I'll get the new jersey, if they get the new
This is a Christmas present type
right.
thing. Don't listen, sons. That's not what you're getting for Christmas.
They've already put in the request.
I got it.
Santa's on alert, yeah.
Okay, let's talk Delaware, a state that you reported on for many, many, many years, Mark. Some news yesterday there.
Yeah, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester launching her bid for the U.S. Senate seat, which has been held for a very long time, since 2001, by Senator Tom Carper, who's not running for a re-election. Lisa Blunt Rochester's the first woman, the first black representative in Congress from Delaware. Mm. So she's made history. She's trying to do that again, to become the first woman and the first black senator from Delaware. Delaware being a very Democratic state, there's and she's very well liked in the state. So it's a very strong possibility that this could be an open and shut case. The Republicans have not, there's no Republicans in the race as of yet.
Zero.
Right.
Wow.
So they're still trying to find a candidate. And, we still have a lot of time before that happens,
sure.
before the election happens next year. But, it's really Blunt Rochester's race to lose by a long shot, for sure.
That was my sense standing from afar and looking at this from the shores of Pennsylvania, that this seems kind of sewn up already, that maybe the party insiders have kind of anointed her. I mean, is there any rumbling that any other Democrat would even run against her?
Not that I have heard, and I would be very surprised if that were to happen. And it's sort of the Delaware way of doing things, that the party sort of sets – there's such a deep bench of – Democrats in Delaware, because they've been so successful. They have every statewide elected office is held by a Democrat in the state. They hold both chambers of the General Assembly. So there's a very deep bench. And The one thing this does open up is an open seat for the U.S. House in Delaware, and that's where you're going to see, I think, your scramble of a very broad Democratic primary candidates. Democrats sort of fighting
against the vacuum created in the U.S. Congress seat, which there's only one in the whole state of Delaware.
Correct.
And so that's a huge race because it makes you a statewide representative in Delaware. So that's where the scramble, that's where the competition might be.
Right. That one, and then the governor's seat will be open as well. So
interesting.
We'll see those.
So some turnover happening in Delaware at some point, maybe. want to end this little news roundup today talking about something that came out this morning. It's new data from the census, the U.S. Census, showing that our country, Mark, is getting older and older and older.
Well, that's a coincidence because so am I.
Well, this might make you feel younger, actually. Okay. You're maybe closer to the median age of the average American than you think. The median age now for an American is 38 years old compared to 30 in 1980. So this has been a long-term trend. And this is actually got real meaning because the older a population is, the more sort of stress that can put on an economy, fewer younger workers to support people who are older who need support.
The healthcare system,
Social Security, et cetera. So there are real implications to this. And also people can make young and old jokes today and I don't feel so old, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, as a person who covers Delaware a lot, that's happening a lot in the first state, too. The sort of graying of the population as people retire, especially towards the Delaware beaches, that's happening in a lot of places.
And I will connect this to Philly, too. One of the root causes, we all know one of the root causes of the population getting older is the fact that there's a lower birth rate. Okay, less kids.
Right.
But one of the other big reasons is that immigration has slowed. That's a huge deal in Philadelphia because Philadelphia's, I wouldn't call it a population boom, but its growth in the 21st century population-wise was really fueled by immigration. And so as that slows, that means that Philadelphia's prospects moving forward might look a little dimmer. So there are like real local implications to this. And it's just one of those big trends. You don't get often a chance to talk about big trends. It's always like what's happening today in the news, blah, blah, blah. This is like a big trend that also creates a headline that gives us a chance to talk about something that really does matter.
And has ramifications for many, many years to come.
Absolutely. All right. So let's transition now to our newsmaker segment for the day, Mark. We're going to welcome in State Senator Anthony Williams, who represents parts of Philadelphia and Delaware County in the Pennsylvania State Senate. Yesterday, Senator Williams announced his affiliation with the centrist Forward Party. He was standing in the state capitol in Harrisburg alongside former presidential candidate Andrew Yang.
So the Forward Party is here to provide those resources to legislators that want to take a stand for a better form of politics and get away from the ideological warfare that is unfortunately defining too much of our news.
Senator Williams, thank you for joining us today on Studio 2.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Senator, is this a way to sort of differentiate yourself from other Democrats, especially in a place like Philadelphia where the overwhelming majority of voters are Dems? Is this sort of a way for you to say, this is the kind of Democrat that I am?
A couple things. One, I'd have to push back on the centrist notion. Today I got a probation reform bill out of committee. And if you look at my voting pattern, it's more left than it is anything. It's more an expression of frustration that our democratic process is based upon debate, dissent, and then consensus to compromise. Increasingly, that's just not valued, nor is it allowed. If you are going to be a good anything, a Democrat or a Republican, moderate, a conservative, or progressive, you're required to follow an ideology. And for me, I push back against that. I don't think that I should be required to be, quote unquote, in the Democratic Party, part of an ideology that may not fit the district that I represent or the people that I'm around most of the time. So that's more what it is. And so I don't know. I guess it is a form of expression to say, hey, look who's over here and look who you're missing. But it's not just for the sake of, you know, standing outside the lines to be noticed.
So let's explain to folks how this works. You're still officially registered as a Democrat, right? You still caucus with the Democrats.
Yeah.
So functionally day to day in terms of representing the interests of your constituents, how does this affiliation with the Forward Party change anything?
Well, I would hope that it's no different than other Democrats who are currently operating as socialists, Working Families Party, and a variety of others that operate under the Democratic banner. It sort of tells you clearly that that person that you're voting for has an approach to their politics, an approach to their policies that may be different than some others. And, you know, in Philadelphia, the progressives have branded themselves as a certain type of a Democrat, and they have a certain list of things that they're required to believe in, and I don't agree with those things. So, you know, I want to make sure people understand there are a variety of Democrats. And in my case, a significant portion of African Americans who simply don't agree or align themselves with the progressive ideology, but have, frankly, some progressive values in them, but don't think that there should be a litmus test of who we are as Democrats.
So the Forward Party, not legally a political party in Pennsylvania right now, although they're working to get ballot access, is this something that you would be interested in seeing if the Forward Party became its own party and was that sort of legal? You know, could you run as a Forward Party candidate? That's something you would do?
Well, I don't think anyone, again, you know, we have several of those affiliations in Philadelphia, and they've been there for a while. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the Forward Party is any different than them, and I don't think they should be gauged as. I mean, I've had a few questions about that, which I thought was kind of curious, even by Working Families Party members. We're no different than them. They're affiliated with the Democratic Party. They run, you know, as such, and they run under that banner, but they stand for certain principles and certain values, and I stand for certain values. And so I'm not necessarily there to recruit or make it a party so much as make a statement about how we should approach governing more responsibly so we can return value and something to people other than, like, headlines or bumper stickers or press conferences. Folks are in tough situations in Philadelphia. Poverty is real. And it can't be just because we're going to attack systemic racism. What are you going to do about it? What value do you put in? What policy do you move forward? Where do we see the value in government that affects our lives? And so that's where I'm coming from.
And so just to clarify, though, you have no interest in the future in changing your actual party affiliation. You see this simply as a messaging to voters, but not the precursor to a party change.
Yeah, no, I didn't join to get engaged in creating a new party. It wasn't presented to me that way. It wasn't discussed that way yesterday. When I talk to Andrew, he's never discussed that. So if that's what happens, that would be based upon, you know, a large population of people who would say, we think this should happen, be it Forward Party or a different type of party possible. And by the way, the fastest growing group of voters are independents. And there's a reason for that, because they're not finding comfort in extremes in either party. Hence, people like me say things like I did yesterday, tired by being required to be on the edge of something. We believe that you should be in government to find consensus, to move budgets, to move policy, to change laws, to impact folks' lives in ways that they can see and feel. With so many people not voting, that's a statement about how they see us conducting ourselves politically, regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican. So that's where I'm coming from.
And that is State Senator Anthony H. Williams, who represents parts of Philadelphia and Delaware counties. Thank you for joining us today, Senator Williams, on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. Take care now.
Also got to thank you, Mark. You hopped in. You did a fantastic job.
My pleasure.
Come back anytime now.
I will.
Coming up on Studio 2, emotions and their effect on memory. If you want to join the conversation, you know where to email, studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. All right, a little memory jog for you. May 12th, 2023, West Reading native Taylor Swift, you've heard of her, filled Lincoln Financial Field.
I'm sorry. I told you
Now, in the hours after that concert, fans recalled the performance and their favorite songs. There was only one problem. In some instances, fans remembered songs that Swift never played. It shows that memory can be flawed and that emotions influence what we remember. Associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Temple and principal investigator of Adaptive Memory Lab, Vishnu Deepumurti, wanted to see how memory is influenced when we're excited at a concert or maybe terrified in a horror movie. So he did something very interesting. Sent a bunch of people to a haunted house. You probably know this haunted house, Eastern State Penitentiary, Terror Behind the Walls. And then he had them recall their experience, and he found some interesting stuff. Deepu joins us now to talk about how trauma and other emotions shape our memory. Deepu, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We want to hear your thoughts and questions about memory. We know you got them. Do you have a story about remembering an event completely different from someone else, or maybe a time your memory totally failed you? Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. All right, Deepu, before we get to the Eastern State stuff, which is fascinating, I want to start very meta.
Yep. Okay.
Do you remember the first time you became interested in the concept of memory as an academic subject?
Yeah, I actually came into it really interested in rat neuroscience.
Rat neuroscience?
Yes, I went to work in my first lab. And it was a rat neuroscience lab. And then I got halfway into the experience and was like, I want more, right? And then quickly switched to studying humans so you could really dig deep into what a memory means because it has so many different layers.
So it started with rat memories.
Started with rat memories, which sort of founded a lot of the basis of the research we're doing. But we do everything now in humans just to get a broader scope of the sort of three-dimensional nature of a memory.
All right, we're already off track. But rat, I don't even know how do you gauge or understand what rats are remembering?
So they do really interesting tests. For example, one you can do is place an old object and a new object that they've never seen before in the same room and see how much time they're spending with one object versus the other. They love new things, so they'll sort of nose around more in a new object than an old object, and that lets you sort of get a sense of what they have in there. But it's a lot easier to ask people than to set up these rings.
What you do now is, I suppose, easier, but still not easy, because memory does seem like a pretty tough thing to study. It's so shaped by perception and reaction. So I want you to talk about this project you did where you sent people to Terror Behind the Walls at Eastern State, and then sort of got their sense of what they remembered afterward, right? So walk me through this experiment, how it worked, and what you found.
So what we did is we had typically been trying to study these types of fearful and trauma memories in the lab. But that means, okay, we'll show you a picture of a snake, or we'll show you a picture of a spider versus something really boring like a book, right? But when you think back in your life, those memories that really have that emotional tinge to it, they're so much more complicated. So this is why we went to the haunted house at Eastern State, is we wanted to get people immersively in a full-bodied experience to then see what they remembered. So we had them go there, and if you haven't been there, it's awesome, high recommend, terrifying. But what's neat about it is they have all these different types of rooms, right? So one room might be like hospitals and blood, where another room might be post-apocalyptic and guns, right? So each one has its own...
They're quite distinct.
Yeah. Right, different flavors. And we had people wearing heart rate monitors at the time because you might be really scared of blood. I might be really scared of
clowns. I'm scared of all of it, by the way.
Right. But then rather than thinking about what was happening in that moment, we could say, how aroused was that person in that specific moment in that room, right? Which let us sort of get this idea that everybody's different and might have different sort of points of what they find terrifying or not. And what does that do to memory? So when they came back a week later, we tested their memory for the different events. And the thing that we predominantly found was that when you were specifically showing high heart rate, your heart's pumping because it's the thing that you really are afraid of the most, we were seeing memory changes that you started to focus really narrowly on the sensory details of what's happening versus sort of the gestalt experience of where you are.
Well, so, give me an example of that.
Perfect. Yeah. So imagine you're in a hospital room and a bloody nurse is approaching you with a syringe, right? If that's terrifying for me, not for somebody else. You might have really great memory for what that syringe looked like or sort of the deep hues of the blood that was on the nurse's outfit, but less memory of what did the cabinet look like in the background? Huh. How did I walk in this room? Who was I with, right?
It's so stuff very, very sort narrow of, focus and less peripheral.
Narrow focus on the elements of sort of the that most terrified you in sort of really intact sensory details of that, but it's sort of at the expense of everything else that's around it.
So what are the implications of that for, you know, we first thought, when I heard about this, I thought about criminal justice, eyewitness accounts, but maybe there are other implications. I mean, what does this suggest about memory that might be more broadly applied?
Yeah, so I think your intuition is correct in the same place we're thinking about of what does this mean to the criminal justice system. We rely a lot on eyewitness testimony when we are trying to resolve things in legal settings, and it's up to jurors to sort of extract how truthful they feel somebody is being or how accurate they're being in the world. And this is complicated, right? If it is something that is the focus of the event, they might be spot on accurate, but at the same time be completely inaccurate about features that happened before or after. And I've been really pushing lately that we need to have more crosstalk with memory scientists and legal systems to say, hey, this person, you can't discredit what they're saying about fact A just because they did poorly on fact B, because fact B might not be what was important to them.
Interesting. So oftentimes in a trial, right, you might say someone might have misremembered something, and then the defense attorney will say, this shows this person has bad memory. But you're saying it's possible to misremember something in the same moment that you are remembering something very well.
Exactly. So I think the idea of an unreliable witness is a little bit too black or white thinking.
It's binary.
Exactly. Yeah. It needs to be continuous about what part of the event are we trying to unfold in a given moment.
This is so tough because, I mean, eyewitness testimony is completely crucial to solving crimes. There are some maybe systemic flaws in how we remember things in really stressful moments. So what do you kind of started to talk about it there. What do you hope policymakers will do with this information? Or, you know, it's evolving, right? I know it's the science is still evolving, but what do you hope they start to do with the information?
Yeah, so there's two approaches that people are handling this with. One is, are there markers that we can find that are happening in real time that can give us more confidence based above and beyond just the words they're using? People are saying how fast they are to retrieve the information might actually give you a sense of their accuracy. And there's some promising early data there. I tend to take another approach of let's just inform the jurors about how memory works, right? Yeah. Maybe let's induce a little bit more uncertainty into the mix. Like you said, get rid of the binary thinking and appreciate the complexity that's there. We're not going to get black or white answers from an eyewitness testimony.
So let's do that right now. I want you to tell us how memory works. So first, biologically, how do our brains form memories? Like what's lighting up in there when memories are happening?
Yes, so it's pretty cool. It's very linked with the sensory information or the perceptual information that's coming in. So your brain's really adept at solving those things. But then what's interesting is depending on the state you're in, whether you're aroused or whether you're angry or whether you're fearful or whether you're curious, right? Different neuromodulatory systems will come on. So you might have heard of things like the dopamine system or cortisol or noradrenaline, and they can actually shift where that information is going, and then that will determine the nature of the memory that's forming, right? Huh. So in one instance, we have this region, the hippocampus. You hear this a lot with amnesics. If they lose their hippocampus, they have a hard time learning. But that's one of many memory systems that exist in the brain. And the nature of that memory will basically be depending on the state that you are in a given moment and where that information is eventually going to land.
Fantastic and fascinating. So, by the way, if you just joining us, we're talking to Vishnu Deepumurti, who is the Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Temple and Principal Investigator at the Adaptive Memory Lab. We're talking all things memory. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We have a comment from Adriana, and I bet you get asked this at parties all the time, Deepu. What tricks do you recommend to remember things better? How can I improve my memory?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, things like exercise and diet are surprisingly really good for memory, just keeping your brain active. These are sort of gestalt lifestyle changes that have downstream influences on memory.
So when you say diet, does that mean just like a good diet, or I should eat acai berries or something specific?
You know, nothing specifically is found except more just healthy people have better memories. But that doesn't really get at the moment when you really want to learn something. And this might sound really trivial, but my advice would be try to find a way to care about it, right? Huh. The more that you can get excited or curious and sort of attach it to prior knowledge that you have, the more likely you are to remember that information, because our brain wants to absorb information that matters and is built quite adaptively to forget information that doesn't matter. So if you want to remember it, ask yourself, why does this matter to me? And that's going to help stamp it in better.
What's the evolutionary purpose of memory? Like, why do we remember things? Like, I mean, I understand like why I need pattern recognition or something to go about my daily life, but I don't understand why I need to remember what my preschool classroom looked like, which I do, by the way. Like,
right.
What is the evolutionary purpose of this?
Yeah, I mean, so the interesting thing about evolution is it's not perfect, right? It's going to select for things that help, and then other things come along for the ride.
The ancillary things, they're just kind of like the gifts that it picked up along the way.
Exactly, yeah. Right? Yeah. You don't always know what's important in the moment that you find it, right? You think about a detective, Sherlock, sees everything, then the aha moment comes, you then have to go back and try to figure out what matters. So I think we overlearn things to help us solve the problems that later become important. So if you're on a treasure hunt, right, it's going to be important to remember the cues that predict where the treasure was. Or even better, if you're foraging for fresh fruit that you want to eat versus spoiled fruit, you want to remember, you know, what patches of land were better, what patches of land were worse. Does it make an important statement that the tree a couple blocks away is turning brown and has moss on it? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you won't know until you find the thing that you did. And
so it's like a dragnet and you're getting all this information. Some of it's useful, some of it isn't. But you do remember some of the not useful stuff because like your memory, it's doing what it's supposed to do.
It provides the scaffold to help you solve these problems. And I think what's really important about these sort of episodic memories, the ones that we can share with others and say out loud, is then that means not only do I have this information for myself, but I can share it with you on the radio,
right? Yeah,
right?
Exactly,
you can communicate information so you don't have to live every experience on your own. And it gives you this beautiful system that lets you vicariously learn through your social networks.
I have a comment here from Louise. This is interesting. My daughter remembers very little from the first 11 years of her life, even big events like a visit to Disneyland. Is there a difference in how we form memories when we're young?
Yes, and our lab just started scratching the surface of this in the past 3 to 5 years. But one of the models, which there's many, it's a very contentious field, is that when you're young, especially in these ages of, you know, 3 to 5, you're learning to understand the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of need that to lay down first before you can start to grab these really precise memories. So people think that when you're younger, you actually end up merging memories more often, right? So rather than having a very distinct memory of one visit to the grocery store, you're trying to build sort of a model of what grocery stores are like, right? Mm. If you have really specific memories, it's sort of hard to put them together to get one model of how the world's working. But something amazing happens between the ages of 4 to 6 when people have sort of laid down these ideas of concepts of their world, that then they can start getting the really precise memories.
Ah, interesting. So sort of general collage-style memory when you're younger and then more specific memories as you get a little older?
Right. And let me give you a great example that I think sort of clicked in my head when I thought about this. How do I have a memory of my mom before I know who my mom is or what a mom is in general, right? You sort of need that general knowledge before you can build up to forming tight memories.
Okay, so this is a fascinating comment from Sylvia. When my husband and I get in an argument, and I can relate to this here, we have very different recollections of what was said and how it was said. Can you explain why that happens?
If I could, I'd be in a very happy relationship. I am in a happy relationship. Ooh, he's probably listening.
Disclaimer.
So I think the idea of this is that often when we first started studying memory, it was so much about the content, right? Am I looking at something that's scary? Am I looking at something that's boring? But then as we've been growing in the past sort of 30 years, and up until now new research is coming out that is that our whole world is filtered by the goals in our head, right? We're going to find different things exciting and different things important and different things salient when we look at a conversation. And it's those features of salience and excitement and curious or anger in the context of a fight that sparks the different brain mechanisms that really make some memories more strong than others. So you can think in the context of a fight, you're going to really remember the things that hurt you to your core, or you're going to remember the things that make you right, but that information might be really uninteresting or completely mundane to the person that you're in a fight with. And we're currently trying to unpack that now, where we're actually having people talk to each other in real time and try to extract what features of memory they are pulling out from the exact same conversation.
I'm going to add my own disclaimer now. I'm in a wonderful relationship. I love you, sweetie, by the way. I wasn't trying to say that we fight a lot. So I want to ask you about a problem that I'm having, Deepu, something that I've had my whole life, okay? When I meet someone for the first time, which happens a lot in my profession, I'll remember all sorts of weird biographical details that they told me about their life, like where they're from, something specific about their job. I swear 9 times out of 10, I cannot remember their name after the first meeting. And sometimes I'm even trying to do that, and it eludes me. Can you possibly explain what's going on with me?
Yeah, and I'm going to sound like a broken record, but maybe broken records are okay. Again, it's what's important in the conversation, right? You're sitting down and talking to me right now. Hopefully the things that I'm telling you about memory are much more interesting than that my name is Deepu.
That's true.
Right?
That's true.
So when you're drawing back to think about what there is to recollect and what's sort of lingering in your head, these are the things that strengthen in memory, that it lingers. The name is almost the most relevant feature of the whole memory. So I say, as a memory researcher, who cares if you forget their name if you can remember something about the interaction?
You just gave me my out.
Yes.
So here's a comment from Kyle. I remember being at an occasion with my family that I was never at. Why? So I'm guessing from what Kyle's saying that the occasion did happen, but Kyle wasn't there, but Kyle remembers being there. What's going on?
Yeah, so this is a pretty awesome phenomenon that exists that's really hard to study in the context of a laboratory. But people have some really good theories about what's happening. And I think it's explained that a memory is not a static thing. It is not a library book that is, you know, packed away and then you pull it out and you can look at it and put it back. I think a better metaphor is that it is a whiteboard or a journal, right, or a document that you can edit. So every time you open up a memory, right, in some ways you are rewriting the memory or modifying it or editing it, right? So every time you open it, that means it becomes slightly more malleable. So if the person, I think Kyle was it?
Yeah, Kyle.
If Kyle is around his family a lot and they are talking about this evidence, at some point when he is just reliving the telling of the story, all it takes is that slight modification that it gets introduced, that he put himself into there, and then that memory gets folded back in and solidified, right? So these memories are like living cyclical things that are recycled and
memories not
and
static.
Exactly. And I think that's the big thing, is that it is not static, which means it's open to things like putting yourself in an event that you were never there.
Fortunately, we got to leave some fantastic questions on the table today because we're out of time. This was a fascinating conversation. It's a memorable one.
Good. You don't need to remember my name.
I will. That's Vishnu Deepu Murthy, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Temple, Principal Investigator at the Adaptive Memory Lab. Deepu, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And we would love to have you back. Coming up, we're doing some trivia. Got one lucky contestant on the line standing by. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
And we are winding down the week here at Studio 2. Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, and today it's time for another Trivia Thursday. That's how we always wind down the weeks at Studio 2. I am joined on the phone right now by our contestant, Hillary, who is a Wisconsin native, joining us now from West Philadelphia. Hillary, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thank you so much.
You're a Wisconsin native, and as is our star producer, Debbie Builder, so I have to ask you, is there anything you miss most about the state of Wisconsin, the Badger State?
Well, besides my lovely mom and dad, It would have to be fresh cheese curds.
I've had fresh cheese curds, and we are missing out. Do we not have that in Philadelphia? I feel like that would be a hit.
It's hard to find in Philly. Yeah. It's hard to find. Yeah.
Well, some lucky entrepreneur will work on that idea, and we'll have fresh cheese curds here in Philadelphia. But for the meantime, we're going to do a little trivia with you, Hillary. And the way this works is if you get it right, you get, and this is a big deal, a Studio 2 grocery tote bag. There's going to be four choices, so make sure to listen to all four choices. And then feel free to walk us through your thinking process as you mull this question. So here it is. We talked earlier this hour about third parties in politics. Since 1913, when Pennsylvania began to directly elect its U.S. senators, only one third party has ever gotten more than 20% of the vote in a U.S. Senate election here in Pennsylvania. Which party is it? Are we talking about A, the Prohibition Party, B, the Socialist Party, C, the Party in the USA, or D, the Progressive Party?
Well, I would really love it if it was C, Party in the USA.
I would too, yes.
But I just, something's telling me that's not the right one. And I'm not an expert on politics, so it's a little bit hard for me to choose between the other three. But I think, I know that at one point Prohibition was pretty popular.
Yep.
So I'm going to go with that one. I think that was... No, it's not right.
Oh, I'm so sorry. By the way, though, can I just say, though, before I tell the answer, that's actually really good thinking. The Prohibition Party was real in Pennsylvania. It is the third party they got second closest. There was a candidate in 1920 who got over 130,000 votes running for the Prohibition Party. But the answer was the Progressive Party. 1914, Gifford Pinchot got 24% of the vote as a member of the Progressive Party. But I had fun with you. It was a party for me, Hillary.
It was for me as well. Thank you so much.
And wishing you a great weekend. Thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2. And cheese curds, folks, let's get them in Philly.
Yes. Thank you.
So I'm also thinking about the weekend, by the way. Hopefully the rain will clear out. We can enjoy some things. And, of course, to tell us about some fun things, we always have WHYY's Tanya Pendleton.
Don't let it rain on your parade.
I can't stand the rain against my window.
Philly is scheduled for rain for the foreseeable future, at least through the weekend as summer officially arrives with some cleansing showers. Or at least that's how we'll think of it. So break out those plastic ponchos, as many outdoor events planned for the weekend are going on, rain or shine. The Welcome America Festival has begun. That's the 16 days from Juneteenth to the 4th of July that celebrate America's independence. Philly is the birthplace of democracy, so we better live it up. You already know about the party on the parkway with Ludacris and Demi Lovato on the 4th, but there are a host of events leading up to it. One of them is the two-day Hispanic Fiesta, which happens on Saturday and Sunday at Penn's Landing. This is the first year the festival is under the Welcome America umbrella. It goes from 2 p.m. to 9 p.m. both days, and on Saturday, the headliner is Manny Manuel. On Sunday, Jose Alberto El Canario closes out the fest. We'll have all the info on Welcome America on our website, whyy.org/things to do. If it rains on Kidchella, the show will go on. That's what organizers say about the concert series that kicks off on Friday as part of Welcome America.
Suppose your nose was where your elbows goes. Would you call them smellbows? Would you call them smellbows?
The concert featuring Johnny Shortcake and Alex and the Kaleidoscope features pre-show activities including face painting, glitter tattoos, food trucks, an art zone, and giveaways. It all happens at the Smith Playground starting at 4 p.m. And parents, you're especially going to love this event because it's free with registration. You don't have to be a kid to enjoy the Too Many Games Festival, but we'll bet that you started playing many of them during your childhood. This is a festival for gamers, but not just for Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto aficionados. It's the longest-running video and board game convention in the state, going from Friday through Sunday at the Greater Philadelphia Expo Center in Oaks. Special guests include voice actors, influencers, and YouTube personalities. There are many games that have stood the test of time, and so has this soundtrack. It's among the most instantly recognizable pieces of music in movie history. The Philadelphia Orchestra will play it in its entirety when they screen Star Wars: The Force Awakens at the Man on three ginormous screens. It happens on Saturday at 8 p.m., and it's a rain or shine event. We recommend you get there early because the first 1,000 people through the doors will get a voucher for a free bag of popcorn. May the Force be with you. The Force of Music has remained with Robert Smith even if his original band members haven't. The frontman for the British band, The Cure, has moved on with other musicians but is still playing arenas. The revamped Cure heads to Wells Fargo on Saturday on the Twilight Sad Tour. The show starts at 7:30. Rufus Wainwright is also on the road, proving classic music is always in style. Elton John once said he was one of the best songwriters on the planet. Young girls are coming to the gather. On his latest album, Folkocracy, he duets with Susanna Hoffs, Brandi Carlile, John Legend, and Chaka Khan. He'll be at the Miller Theater on Friday night with special guests Lucy Wainwright Roach and Petra Hayden. The show starts at 8. Sounds like it's time for us to head out, and we're going to go on a motorcycle. The American Historic Racing Motorcycle Association is having its Vintage Motorcycle Festival and Swap Meet at the New Jersey Motorsports Park in Millville. That's going on from Friday through Sunday. If you are a biker, or you want to be, or you just like bikers, that's the place you should be this weekend. Things to Do has come to the end of this week's Road, but we'll be back next Thursday. We invite you to our website, whyy.org/things to do, for more, including where you can find Big Beer Fest in Jersey and at the Philadelphia Zoo. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
And it was wild doing this show without Cherry for a few episodes, I have to admit. And I have to thank Mark Eichmann, Shirley Min, Sammy Keola, and Mary Cummings Jordan for filling in so capably. Could not have done it without you. Also, could not have done it without Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes, our producers. WHYY's audio general manager is Joan Isabella. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and if you want to know more about our show, head on over to whyy.org/studio2 or download us wherever you get your podcasts. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg, yes, is back with us on Tuesday. Thanks.